You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, UW researchers have invented a new virtual camera that can help people see around corners. We'll talk to one of the scientists behind that project. Now, one of the biggest immigration raids in more than a decade took place last week in Mississippi with the arrest of close to 700 immigrants suspected of living and working in the country illegally. The raids were just one part of the Trump administration's plan to deal with illegal immigration, an issue that'll be a core part of Trump's reelection strategy in 2020. But a report from the Washington Post is raising new questions about the Trump organization's own use of workers living in the country without documentation. The report says that's continued until as recently as this year. Joshua Partlow is part of the Washington Post's National Political Enterprise and Investigations team. Josh, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
We'll talk about the part of the Trump business empire that you focused on that relied as recently as 2019, relied on workers living in the country without legal status.
Yeah. So in this latest article, we looked at a construction crew that has been working for the Trump organization for basically the past 20 years. It started out as a group of stonemasons primarily that worked at the president's golf course in Westchester County and as well as in Bedminster, New Jersey. And over the years, they did projects. They did rock walls. They did chimneys for homes on the golf courses, fountains, waterfalls, things like that, all up and down the East Coast at his courses. And many of these workers we found were immigrants from Latin America who did not have legal status, did not have the proper documents to be working legally in the United States.
You talked to some of these workers, supervisors, and others. Can you talk about your investigation and what you turned up?
Yeah, so we focused on a man named Jorge Castro, who's an Ecuadorian immigrant, and he has worked there for the past worked for this construction outfit for the past 9 years. You know, I mean, he says basically they're a low profile group. They go by their company name, which is owned by Trump, is called Mobile Payroll Construction, and they're dispatched to different golf courses where they need jobs. So he said he was undocumented, and all the other people he worked with on the crew were as well.
And you looked at the early days of this group. It sounds like it was originally a separate contractor, and the contractor in that case, the workers said that he told them, "Hey, go to this place. You'll be able to get documentation."
Yeah, that's right. Another worker that we spoke with, former worker, said that he had been told specifically by the manager of this crew to go to Queens, to go on a sidewalk in Queens and buy his fake Social Security and green card so they could put something in the Trump Organization files, which he said he did in 2002. He paid $50 for it. And that's a story that's very consistent that we've heard over and over by all the, several workers that we've interviewed who were undocumented and worked for the Trump golf course, particularly in Westchester. It's easy to get to Queens, easy to buy those documents. They go to Roosevelt Avenue. This former worker also said that there was one time when labor union officials from New York visited the Westchester County course to inspect the construction site, and he says that their boss at the time instructed them to go hide for a couple hours so these labor union officials wouldn't see undocumented or non-unionized labor on the job site.
What is the benefit to this Trump-owned business to hire these workers, these undocumented workers?
Well, they often don't get it's primarily a financial benefit. The wages are lower, we found, than comparable either union labor for these construction jobs or comparable labor at other companies or industries. They don't get benefits often, including health insurance or overtime pay. You know, I think there's a situation where these workers say they're often very afraid to complain about working conditions. An earlier story we wrote focused on how the Westchester golf course was asking people to clock out. This was in the kitchen staff, and then continue to work extra hours, and they weren't being paid. And that was a practice that was being looked into by the New York State Attorney General's office. So I think people, undocumented workers, are in the situation where they're feel like they're holding on to this job for dear life in many cases, and they don't want to cause any problems. They don't want to complain to their bosses, so they accept working conditions that are worse than people who might have papers.
Talking to Joshua Partlow from the Washington Post, looking at the Trump Organization's use of undocumented labor up to 2019. Josh, you've looked at other parts of the Trump Organization and past use of undocumented labor. What kind of things have we seen over the years?
Well, I mean, the pattern that seems to be emerging is that this the Trump Organization really relied on undocumented labor in a big way and a fundamental way for many years. One of the stories we did was about the workers who had actually physically built the Bedminster, New Jersey golf course where the president is this week. Many of them were from Costa Rica. There's a Costa Rican immigrant community in Bound Brook, New Jersey, which is near the golf course. And we went back to Costa Rica and found people who used to work, who were knocked down the trees to make the fairways and carved out the sand traps and actually physically built the golf course. And then dozens of undocumented workers over the years continued to do jobs in housekeeping, in the kitchen, in the maintenance, and the greenskeeping staff. And that, you know, we've found that's been the case at the golf courses we've been able to write about so far. That's been the case at all of them. So it seems like it's been it's pretty fairly common practice for the company.
What have we heard from the Trump business itself and the Trump family about what they know and how they try to whether they try to screen for proper documentation?
So the company says that they in these media reports over the past year have been essentially the first they've heard about this issue. They say these workers who are undocumented submitted fake papers, and therefore it's not necessarily their responsibility to determine if these papers are fake or not. So they said they'd conducted an audit after an initial round of stories and then fired several of the workers at several golf courses. Their official stance is that whenever they have information if someone's undocumented, they will be removed from the company.
There is a way for business to check you write about called E-Verify. What is that, and has the Trump Organization been using it?
Yeah, E-Verify is a government database, federal government database, where employers can send in their employees' Social Security numbers, and the government will verify if this is an accurate number and is associated with that person. The Trump Organization had a couple of its properties, golf courses, registered in the E-Verify system earlier in the year, but the majority were not. In some cases, it's mandatory on a state level. But so recently, within the past couple months, now the Trump Organization has put all of its golf courses onto E-Verify. This construction company we wrote about this week we haven't been able to find their name in the E-Verify database, although the Trump Organization, we asked them, said that entity itself is also registered with E-Verify. One thing about the database is it's not mandatory to be in. The companies don't have to come up in the public listing, apparently. So it's not what the names in the database are not necessarily all the names who have signed up.
Now, this is a president and candidate who's campaigned with illegal immigration as a front and center issue. Have you heard anything from either the Trump presidential campaign or the Trump administration in response to this on the political side of things?
Not really. President Trump, his most recent comments on the issue came last month when he said that he didn't know if there were undocumented workers at the Trump Organization because he doesn't run the company. Day-to-day, he still owns the company. Day-to-day control of it his sons are in control of the company. But But no, President Trump has not made much comment about the issue. And, you know, there have been some calls by congressional Democrats for investigations by the FBI, by the Department of Homeland Security, into the Trump Organization's hiring practices. But so far, there hasn't at least been any public indication that that's happening.
And I mentioned at the outset this big raid in the South on a company that had a lot of undocumented workers. Has there been any sign of enforcement activity from federal immigration officials when it comes to Trump-owned businesses?
No, we haven't seen anything like that. You know, the acting CBP director was asked recently about that on one of the news programs, and he didn't answer the question directly about whether the Trump Organization was – whether they were looking into the Trump Organization or not, essentially saying in general that sometimes the public doesn't know about all the investigations that are going on in the background. So no, but there's definitely been no public indication that any kind of enforcement activity or raid has happened at the Trump Organization.
Josh, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks a lot.
That's Joshua Partlow, reporter on the Washington Post's National Political Enterprise and Investigations team. He was with us today to talk about his latest piece about the Trump Organization's use of immigrant workers living in the country without documentation. Coming up, we'll talk to a UW researcher who helped build a camera that can see around corners, which could help in firefighting, surgery, and more. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, UW researchers have built a new version of a camera that can see around corners. We'll find out how it works and the effect it could have on warfare, surgery, and a lot more. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum, who takes us on a miniature train ride.
An historic railway dating back to the 1940s welcomes thousands of families to southern Wisconsin every year. Courtney Everett rides the rails to learn more about steam locomotives.
Tourists come from near and far to visit the Wisconsin Dells. Tucked off County Road N, there's the smell of coal and a sound that draws families to the Riverside and Great Northern Railway. Nearly 16,000 families come yearly to ride a mini steam locomotive through the woods.
I love it. I love coal smoke in my lungs and steam oil in my veins.
That's board member, conductor, and engineer Jim Schultz of Sheboygan. He says Elmer and Norman Sandley created the mini railway in Janesville in the late 1940s, called the Sandley Light Railway Equipment Works.
Our track is 15-inch gauge.
It's a much smaller version of tracks back then. The Preservation Society acquired the railway and its facilities after the father-son team moved their business to the Dells in the 1950s, and it remains there today. The Sandleys started the business to help tell the story of steam locomotives in the U.S.
There's something about the technology, the moving parts, the smells, the sights, the sounds that just captures your imagination.
Although these locomotives are smaller, retired mechanical engineer Gary Martin says 250 volunteers work to preserve the railway. He says maintaining it, along with two steam locomotives and 14 buildings, is a year-round job.
We've got one member that basically does nothing but paint. About the time he gets done with the last one, he's ready to start over again.
But right now, volunteers are focused on repairing their track. Preservation Society President Stephen Bradley says heavy rainfall destroyed half the railway last summer.
We got 4 inches of rain in about 2 hours' time, and then we got an additional 10 inches of rain throughout the night.
That created landslides and washouts, creating a shorter ride than usual.
We are making an extra trip out to help make up for the rail lost time that you would have.
But on a warm summer morning, that doesn't stop volunteers from getting Locomotive 98 up and running.
It takes about two and a half hours to fire up a steam engine. It takes a while to boil 50 gallons of water.
Back it up to the water tank, fill it up with water, couple to the passenger cars that are in place already, and first train at 10.
And you can't forget the coal.
Wow, that's a small football. It'll burn.
than families like the Wojaks await departure.
Kids love the trains. I like the trains. That's why we came out.
We were here when he was like 3 months old, maybe, or maybe a year old. And so we were just coming back to see it.
As the top of the hour approaches, you hear a familiar phrase and know it's time.
All aboard!
How old are you?
3.
3? We'll give you 2 extra punches.
Once aboard one of 8 windowless passenger cars, families take in nature, fresh air, and get to learn more about the railway.
This is a direct fuel injector. Don't worry, it's a shovel.
After it's over, it's not really over for railway volunteers.
It's a good place, great people, worthy cause.
Who get to do it again tomorrow.
Beautiful scenery. And did I mention steam locomotives?
WPR's Courtney Everett brought us that story on the Riverside and Great Northern Railway, which runs through October. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, researchers at UW-Madison have helped create a new kind of virtual camera with the ability, apparently, to see around corners. It's technology that could have a lot of real-world applications from everything from surgery to firefighting. Andreas Felton is an assistant professor in the Department of Biostatics and Medical Informatics at UW-Madison. He's also part of the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering. He was the lead researcher on this project. Andreas, thanks a lot for joining us up here in the studio.
Thanks for having me.
Now, people have been working on this kind of imaging, I understand, for a lot of years now. What did you and your group do to try to push this idea forward of helping us see around corners?
Well, so what we have done in this current published work was that we really changed the way to think about how to do these, how to do the computation that's involved in this. So far, a lot of, as you say, a lot of different researchers have tried to tackle this problem, and they all develop their own kind of individual understanding, their own algorithms for this. And that's different from any other kind of imaging. There's ultrasound imaging and gravitational wave imaging now and optical imaging, and they all have their same underlying theory, which is very useful because you can exchange information from one to the other. And what we really have done is to point out that, well, if you can formulate this problem in the right way, it also becomes part of the same theory, and we can really think of this non-line of sight imaging, the seeing around corners, of projecting a virtual camera.
Mm-hmm.
So
if you asked me how to solve this problem, I'd say it's easy. You can't. It's impossible. Can you talk about the technology that you and your team are using to let me look, I don't know, down a hallway and maybe ultimately see what's over there where I can't see? What's happening?
So, yeah, imagine that you had a device that is not a camera itself, but it can project a virtual camera onto a surface anywhere, any surface that you can see, right? So you can pick a surface down a hallway and say, okay, I would like this wall to be my virtual camera, and I'd like to see what I could see from this wall, what this virtual camera would see. And what we do to do this is we send short laser pulses to this surface, and then the light from those laser pulses bounces off that surface and goes into this hidden part of the scene that we can't see directly. It comes back from there and then bounces back again off the relay surface, and we have a very fast camera that can actually see the light coming back. And it's fast enough to actually see it as a function of time. It can measure the light, which is very fast. It moves at the speed of light. And from that, we can then reconstruct images of this hidden scene.
Okay, A, wow. And B, how do we reconstruct that image? That sounds like, well, among the many tricky parts of this.
Yes. Essentially, I mean, you basically, from the point of your image, from your own vantage point, you know where you sent the light onto this relay wall, and you know from where it came back, because you can see that, you can make a video of what's coming back. And because it's so fast, you also know the time it took to travel between all these points. And so the reconstruction algorithm uses all of this information and basically gets us a tomographic reconstruction of this room. And as I said, in this current paper, what we really noticed is that this reconstruction algorithm is really no different from what you would do if you wanted to reconstruct an image that from the light that happens that hits the aperture of your camera that also has light arriving at different points in the scene at different times, and then you have to reconstruct an image from that. So it's basically the same diffraction math that's helping the camera reconstruct its images or our eyes.
We're still working in the lab setting here, but how clear a picture are we getting? If I'm the thing standing around the camera, is like, oh yeah, that's Rob, or that's a person, or that's a humanoid. How clear is the picture?
So we get about like relatively close to the wall at about a meter or two away. We get about down to a few centimeters of resolution. So you can definitely tell the difference between a person and an animal. We can even make out like hand gestures. We have only looked at mannequins so far. We haven't looked at real people yet. We have been looking at books and things like that. So an object, we looked at an office scene, you can make out chairs. So this kind of resolution is what you get when you're relatively close.
Can you talk about some of the applications? What kind of work could we put this to as we get it more and more resolved?
So there's a lot of different regions and a lot of different scales this could be used in. And the immediate ones are if we're looking at scenes like room-sized scenes, which would be interesting. You mentioned the fire department, right? If you have a burning building, you want to know which of the rooms have people in them. That would be a very useful application. Self-driving cars, so any car would benefit from the ability for the driver to see around corners. There's like security applications, disaster response. If there's a collapsed building and you want to quickly scan all the entrances and see where you would find somebody. And then, of course, there's also potential military applications to this, like scanning from the air, scanning from vehicle on the ground, and look whether you can see something going on in buildings that you otherwise couldn't see.
And this is funded in part, you mentioned military applications. The Department of Defense is interested in this. Also, I understand NASA. What kind of things might they have in mind in our last few moments?
This is actually the most active, like the what we're currently doing. NASA is interested in imaging or in learning more about caves on the moon. So this is a fairly recent discovery. I think it was the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter that found these, which is basically just an imaging satellite that orbits the moon, that found these structures that probably are not craters. They have an overhang on the side. And the best understanding of what they are is that they're entrances to lava tubes on the moon, so cave systems. And NASA would really like to be able to go in those, but for that you have to first scout them and see which of those are actually caves, which of them are open. And our system would be perfect to fly in a satellite over there, and a very low orbiting satellite, about 5 kilometers above the surface of the moon, and image into these caves.
Fantastic. Looking forward to some of those images. Andreas, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Andreas Felton from UW-Madison. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6:30 on The Morning Show, a new grant aims to help women who own small businesses in Wisconsin. We'll find out how it works and look at the role of women in entrepreneurship here in the state. It's tomorrow morning at 6:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, when you eat your supper tonight, will you be sitting at the kitchen table? That used to be the norm, but a recent survey says that's not the case anymore. According to the appliance manufacturer June, 72% of American adults said they ate at the table while growing up. Today, that's down to 48%. So where do we go to eat? 30% said the couch has become their primary eating place, up from 12% in their youth. 17% said the bedroom, up from 6% while growing up. To put it another way, the number of people who eat at the table is about the same as the number of people who eat on the couch or in the bedroom. So why are we moving away from the tables, and what does it say about us? Seneca Elliott is assistant professor in sociology at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Her areas of expertise include families and their food practices and interactions. She's co-author of the book Pressure Cooker, Why Home Cooking Won't Solve Our Problems and What We Can Do About It. Seneca, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, now, this survey we mentioned isn't a super scientific thing, but that said, does it seem to match up with trends that our formal sit down with the family around the table meal may not be what it once was?
Yeah. So just to be clear, this is probably not nationally representative data, right? So we need to take the survey with a grain of salt. But that said, There is a potential that it's capturing something that's going on more broadly in the U.S., you know. So one of the things we know is that there are far more people today than in the past who live alone. And that in and of itself can affect how people decide to eat their meals, that whether they decide to sit at the table by themselves, well, maybe not. Maybe they'll stand at a kitchen counter or sit on the couch or a chair, you know, so somewhere more comfortable. They might think of the table as more of a formal setting when you're eating with others. So if you're eating on your own, then, you know, you don't really think of the table as being the place to necessarily sit down. So that could be one explanation, that there are just more people who live alone. And so when they're eating at home, which is what this study was looking at, they're not necessarily sitting down at that dinner table to have their food. There are lots of other explanations. And, you know, our homes are now designed in ways that really de-emphasize the dining room, even if you have a dining room. So that's maybe not necessarily now the focal point in a house as it used to be. So people might be just hanging around a kitchen island or in a lot of the working class and poor families that were included in the five-year study that I recently did, and that's the basis of the book Pressure Cooker, the families didn't even have kitchen tables. They this was a commodity that they just didn't have, or they didn't have room for them in their small, cramped homes. So there are a lot of things that might be going on that are shaping these findings.
Yeah, we heard from Nura on Facebook, who writes, as you just said, maybe they live in small apartments and don't have room for a table. Maybe they work late hours and don't have time to sit with their families. Maybe they're eating at soup kitchens or homeless shelters. And that fits in with a lot of what you and your co-authors who are on the show to talk about Pressure Cooker looked at, the way our economic realities drive our food choices, or in some cases, lack of food choices.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm thinking Nora might have read our book. So one of the things that we also argue, in addition to maybe not having space in your home for a table, more and more Americans are now working non-standard and unpredictable jobs. And so this means that they don't really have very much control over their schedules. They might be in the graveyard shift. They might be working different shifts on different days of the week. And these shifts are often, you know, colliding with the dinner time. And so that means that they might not be home for that standard dinner hour. So this has been a huge shift just in the last four decades, which means that, and this is especially affecting poor and working class families who are much more likely to work in non-standard hours and to report that they work during dinner time hours, potentially making food for other people. But one of the things that we talk about in our book is that this idea that there's some tension and some challenges around meeting the expectation to assemble the family around the table at the end of the day, this isn't new. When we dug into the research, the historical record shows that it's never been easy for American families to gather around the table at the end of the day, even though we have this mythical idea that this used to be very easy. We have this kind of 1950s Leave It to Beaver idea of families sitting around the table. In fact, a lot of families couldn't achieve this, and these were those who did often did so with the help of servants. So they would have people coming into their home to help them prepare these meals and serve these meals. And of course, those domestic servants weren't at home to do this work for their own families. So there's always been a lot of inequalities in who gets to have the time and the resources to sit down at the end of the day around a kitchen table or a dining table.
Talking to Seneca Elliott, assistant professor in sociology at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, co-author of the book Pressure Cooker, looking at changes in how, when, and where we eat. A new non-scientific survey suggests we're less prone to eat at the table, maybe, than we used to be. And Seneca, do we feel guilty that we can't live up to this, what we see as this golden age ideal that may never have been reality in the first place?
Yeah, that's absolutely true, that we found in our research that a lot of people felt that they were letting their families down if they didn't manage to assemble everyone around the table for a healthy, ideally home-cooked meal at the end of the day. And I think this has been so entrenched in our ideas of what it means to be a family and to do family life. And I think some of the alarm that people have expressed about the fact that, you know, families aren't eating dinner together means that this is a big pressure bearing down on families. I will say that, you know, there have been a lot of studies over the years that have argued that families sitting around the dinner table, that this is good for children. It maybe makes children happier, improves their academic performance even, and other outcomes. But there's more recent research has shown us that that research isn't actually accounting for other aspects of family life that may be informing those findings. So families with more resources may be more likely to pull off that end of the day, everyone sitting around the table eating. And it's those parental resources that are, in fact, shaping children's outcomes, not the other way around. Does that make sense?
Definitely. So the reasons that may prevent us from sitting around the table together might also be driving some of those outcomes for kids. It's not the fact of sitting around the table itself.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Now, so we've drawn the... Yeah. Go ahead.
I wanted to turn to eating on the couch. That probably means we're eating in front of the TV. Now, I know in my childhood and in my parenthood, the TV trays come out for a special occasion, an important sporting event or something like that. As part of your research, did you see people eating in screen-centered ways, gathering around in front of the TV to watch something while they eat?
Well, certainly in a lot of the families that we embedded ourselves in, and we spent time, especially in 12 families' homes, these were all lower income families, and they were all part of the broader 5-year study that followed over 150 families from all walks of life. And certainly screens were often on in these households, and whether that was at dinner time or other times, but partly because they were always on, people weren't focusing just on them. They were on, and it was kind of in the background. So it wasn't like all eyes were on the TV. It was just there and kind of part of the background. But, you know, it really varied. We had dinner with one family, and she had a friend over to eat, and also his daughter was staying with her. This is very complicated. And his daughter's boyfriend was also there for dinner. And the mother had her two small children there. Well, she had a little tiny table, and it had three chairs around it. So in the end, her two sons and her friend who was there for dinner ate at the table. She sat in a chair near the TV and occasionally looked at the TV. And her friend's daughter and her boyfriend sat in a bedroom, in a back room, where they ate. You know, so we saw those kinds of dynamics too, where there was kind of a mix of families coming together, helping each other out. The friend who was eating the meal was homeless, and so his daughter was staying with this participant of ours, in part because she needed a place to live, and he needed a good meal, and so she was helping him out. With the idea that when things got better for him, he might be able to help her out. But it did end up being this kind of hodgepodge of people sitting here, there, and everywhere. And if she was the one responding to a survey, she might have said she sat at the couch and she watched a screen. But it wouldn't really fully capture what was going on in that household.
We're talking about the kitchen table and why fewer and fewer of us are eating our meals there. Seneca Elliott is an assistant professor in sociology at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Want to hear from you? Where do you eat your dinner when you're at home? Is it a dining room table, the kitchen table, or the couch, or the bed, or some other place? Why do you eat where you do? Do you all sit down and eat together? Did you eat at the table growing up? You can email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us @CentralTimeWPR. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about where we eat our meals when we're at home. A recent survey from an appliance manufacturer says while 72% of American adults grew up eating at the dining room table or kitchen table, only 48% do that today. 30% eat at the couch, 17% in the bedroom. Seneca Elliott is an assistant professor in sociology at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Her areas of expertise include families and their food practices and interactions. She's co-author of the book Pressure Cooker, Why Home Cooking Won't Solve Our Problems and What We Can Do About It. You can join in the conversation. Where do you eat your meals when you're at home? Is it important that you eat at the kitchen table, or do you eat elsewhere? Where did you eat when you were growing up? Is it important to you that if you're in a family unit at home, that you all eat at the same time in the same place? Email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. We'll go to our callers now. Karen is with us in Appleton. Karen, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to make a comment that my 14-year-old son had come home from a friend's house and said, "Mom, the weirdest thing happened. We sat around the table with my friend's family, and we ate our food around the table." And it was eye-opening to me to think that that's not a norm in our family, that we need to focus more on spending that time together, that he went to somebody's house and they ate at the table and he thought that was weird.
So how do things work out at your house usually, Karen, if I may ask?
Everybody has a different work schedule, yeah. So you know, some people are eating cereal, some people are eating supper at a different time, so it's difficult for us all to get together when the kids are in sports and we work opposite schedules.
I'm there too, Karen. I feel bad about this sometimes. Do you?
Yeah, I feel really bad that we don't all four of us sit together and have those, you know, daily conversations, that we have them separately in the car ride or not together as a family.
Karen, thank you so much for sharing your story. Seneca, I bet a lot of families are in the same boat as Karen's and mine, and a lot of us feel bad about it. Should we, or have we just put too much symbolic importance on that meal together?
I think that we have probably put a lot of symbolic importance on that meal. And what the research suggests is that there are lots of ways to connect with our family members. It doesn't have to happen around a meal, although that can be a nice way and a way that a lot of people do. I think that our modern lives are making it harder and harder to accomplish that. And Karen mentions a couple things: work schedules and also children's involvement in extracurricular activities. And this was another big thing that we found in our research, that parents were busy, you know, shuttling their kids from this activity to the next. And so that this really interfered with the dinner hour. But what research also tells us is that it might be surprising that parents today are actually spending more quality time with their children than were parents in the 1960s. And so I think this is really surprising, but we're actually more likely to be with our children, to be talking with them, to be maybe doing homework with them, compared to the 1960s, which is often that time when we think about, you know, family life as being, you know, very close and full of, you know, harmony and solidarity. So it might give Karen some sense that those car rides are a great time to connect. You know, families can find their own way to have those moments within the day to connect and to pass along, you know, family knowledge and memories.
Karen, thanks for that. We'll go now to Pete with us in Wausau. Pete, hi.
Hi there. Yeah, when we were raising our kids who are in their 20s now, we took that time and opportunity to teach them, kind of touching on what you're saying, interaction, conversation, courtesy, and contribution. So we would eat at the table all together as a family and have conversation. And then we taught the kids things like nobody leaves the table until everybody's done. And the kids all participated in clearing the table, putting the food and dishes away and so forth. And that was even when they were like 5, 6, 7 years old. We were starting them young doing all that stuff. For fun, you know, for changing things up a little bit once in a while, about once a week, we would have special time where we'd have a movie and put it on TV and maybe do a pizza and sit at the coffee table. But the rest of the time, there might have been music on in the background, but no screen or anything like that. And it was just great time to catch up and be a family.
And Pete, was it ever hard to pull it off, especially maybe in the high school years, if the kids had after school, whatever?
We always made it work. That was our priority.
All right. Pete, thanks a lot for the call. Seneca, I think a lot of people want to make it work. It's not always as easy to pull off.
Yeah. And I mean, a lot of people are making it work. So, you know, more than half of American families say they sit down on a really 5 to 7 nights a week with their family to eat a meal. So it's not like this is just vanishing completely. It's still happening. And, you know, for those families that think that this is an important ritual, and I kind of appreciated Pete's like emphasis on these really positive things that they were conveying. And it sounds like it was really positive. I will say that in our research and in other research, there's also some evidence that that dinner time can be a time of conflict, you know, when parents are feeling tired, kids are cranky, it's the end of the day, and your parents are trying to get kids to, like, you know, eat with a fork and use a napkin or whatever it might be. And it can be this moment when there's some sense of frazzleness. And in our research, we found in all the meals that we observed, usually at least one person, sometimes more, usually a child, would refuse to eat something on the plate, and that would lead to some conflict with parents trying to make sure that the kids were getting the food they needed to sleep through the night and feel good the next day, and kids, you know, protesting about having to eat this thing that they hadn't recognized as food.
Yeah, I don't know nothing about that. Seneca Elliott is with us from the University of British Columbia, looking at our changing meal habits. Cheryl is with us in Conover now. Cheryl, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What's your story, Cheryl?
I was a full-time working mother and periodically went away on a plane. And our boys and my first husband, we ate dinner together. And it was my job to make sure that we ate dinner together. If it was a night of athletics or a night I had a meeting, we had an earlier meal or a little later meal, or we had a lighter meal or we had a heavier meal. Or on certain occasions, we would go out for a meal. But that was really important for me, to sit down with my two sons every evening for dinner. And we did it, and they're married to this day, and they do it with their kids.
Cheryl, thanks a lot for that story. Seneca, she made it work. It took some improvisation, though, it sounded like. Is that something you saw in the families that you followed for years?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that this is what's happening. You know, we have these broader things with, Cheryl points out, she was a full-time working mom. She had to travel for work. And so we have all these things that now I think are interfering with, you know, the way that parents, you know, might have done this in the past, where you're all home by 5 or even 4 and you're cooking a meal and then you're eating it. So yeah, we had families who would be prepping vegetables and, cooking food in batches on the weekends so that they could, you know, quickly get those meals together, or, you know, throwing a pizza in the oven so that they could get everybody together around the table when, you know, there was a moment when people were around. So absolutely, people are improvising. People are making do with what they've got. And it's interesting that Cheryl points out this really important moment of, you know, socializing with her kids. And one of the things I wanted to mention when you asked me about people watching screens is my undergraduate students are now telling me that they often will eat meals with their families, but their families are, you know, not in Canada. So they're, you know, internationally. And so they're watching their families on FaceTime or Skype, and they're eating together in that way. And it made me think about this phenomenon of mukbang, which comes from South Korea, which is watching other people eat food. And I have students who tell me that I sometimes just watch other people eat food while they're eating because they kind of want to just connect with someone. So we're coming up with some very creative solutions, I think, to some of these modern dilemmas that we face. I have a good friend who has made breakfast the main meal of the day because that's the only time that all 4 of her family members are around at the same time.
We'll leave it there for now. Seneca, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Rob.
Seneca Elliott is an assistant professor in sociology at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. She's the co-author of Pressure Cooker, Why Home Cooking Won't Solve Our Problems and What We Can Do About It. We talked with her about a survey that shows that more of us over time are eating our meals not at the kitchen or dining room table. Where do you eat your meals when you're at home? Table, couch, bedroom, basement, laundry room, roof? How come? And do you, if you're in a family unit, do you all get together to eat every day, a couple times a week, once a week? Let us know. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, agriculture plays a big role in Wisconsin's economy, but how big? We'll get the results from a new study on the impact of the state's farm and food economy. The Trump administration issued a new rule that could take away green cards for legal immigrants who use any form of public assistance. We'll get the details and talk about the impact that could have. And a lot of Americans are dealing with substantial credit card debt. A personal finance expert tells us what things look like here in Wisconsin and how we can make our debt more manageable. And you can tell us what challenges you've faced right now. Get started over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow after 7, most of us wear clothes. Many of us carry purses. But sometimes the materials they're made of can be bad for our skin. Keely and her guests look at the textiles in our daily lives and how to make sure they're not causing weird reactions. That's tomorrow after 7 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll meet 8 of the women who helped pave the way for America's popular music as we know it today. Rock, blues, country, and more. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.